Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. Now to the views of two political scientists on what Donald Trump said in his inaugural speech and how he'll get it done or not. As our guests join in, I want to know what you heard on Friday in the speech. And I want to know what you think about the way President Trump frames his vision of America. Does it fit with yours? Does it raise some concerns? Dig in a little bit, reflect a little bit on what you heard and some of the analysis that has followed. And then I want you to check that against how you view who we are as Americans and where we're at. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, online, nprnews.org/live, always on Twitter, at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I, NPR. Wendy Schiller is with us. She's chair of the political science department at Brown. And with us today from Providence, Rhode Island, Wendy, welcome back to the show. It's good to talk to you again.
You too, Carrie.
Michael Fauntroy is with us. He's politics professor at Howard University with us from Washington. Michael, you're doing well?
Yes, I am.
Okay, good. Good to have you back on the show.
Thank you.
I want to take a call for both of you here that I think kind of takes us right into the heart of what I wanted to talk about. So let me go to the phones first here to Judy in Longville, Minnesota. Hey, Judy, it sounds like you want to talk about something you heard in the inaugural.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
And for speaking about all this. I found the president's language deeply, deeply disturbing. I am a Lutheran pastor, and his language about righteousness was those words are really buzzwords for a certain form of Christianity that is pushing for a theocracy in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And that is very disturbing to me as a person of faith who recognizes Christianity is not the only religion in our country. Also, the buzzwords America First, if we do our history work, these are deeply troubling, things. And his rhetoric was divisive. And if I was a person of color, if I was a person of another faith, I would, or another orientation, I think his language throughout the campaign and up to his inauguration has been abysmal.
Okay.
And
let me put some of your points to Wendy and Michael. Wendy, did you hear a continuation of much of what Donald Trump presented in the campaign in that inaugural, or did you hear a break and different kind of thinking?
No, I mean, I think the inaugural speech was very similar to his campaign speeches. And in that respect, he delivered a very good speech to his followers, the people who support him, the people who voted for him. In terms of rallying that side of the country, that's what that speech was meant to do. And his advisors wrote exactly that speech. It was delivered very well. So this was not a plea to unify the country, as he said he would do, but it was a plea to shore up the base that voted for him and to put pressure on Congress. He stood up there and insulted Congress, every former president, all the people standing behind him. He insulted outright, but that was also designed to reassure his base that he would not get co-opted by Washington.
Michael, I've been trying to reconcile the portrait of darkness and decay. And he certainly, when he talks about American carnage, he is definitely talking about that, of America, with the reality of a high-powered economy, thriving stock market, low unemployment, and though, I will say, the recognition that there are a lot of Americans who don't feel that they have fully benefited. They've benefited in some ways, but fully benefited from the low unemployment and the resurgence of the economy. How do you mix all that together, and what do you come out with?
Well, first, Carrie, those things can't be reconciled because they're just 180 degrees away from each other. Now, there is a sort of political piece behind this. You know, the Republicans have done a really good job of continuing to talk about how bad the economy is because they know most people don't pay attention to actually what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And so if he can drive down public view or public feelings about the economy and hold those down, and then 6, 8, 9 months from now, start talking it up again, then he can get credit for that as opposed to President Obama. This is a tried and true effort that politicians all over the place use to try to create a potential windfall for themselves down the line. And so we see that now. I mean, most voters don't know that our unemployment rate is about half of what it was when President Obama took office 8 years ago. And so President Trump understands that, and so he's playing to that, for lack of a better phrase, sort of civic ignorance in that regard. And let me just say quickly with regard to what the caller said at the beginning, you know, these buzzwords, as she put them, are very much part of American politics. You may recall that when President Reagan was campaigning and talked about, in his inauguration, making America the shining city on the hill, that is something that has some religious connotations to it, to certain people who understand the concept and believe in the concept of American exceptionalism. And so this inauguration speech was not something that was designed to unify people, but rather was designed to carve out certain cleavages in the American electorate in hopes that those cleavages can be exploited for political gain down the line.
Wendy, I want to follow on what Michael said about what he calls civic ignorance. Is some of that because the fact that many Americans don't know that the unemployment rate is at like about what, four, under 5%, I will say that,
right.
I think it lay at 4.7.
Yeah.
Is some of that because there are plenty of places in America where your health care premiums are rising, you haven't gotten a raise in a while, income inequality is pretty obvious. I mean, does life experience and economic experience bump up against the reality of where the economy is? And is that why people are susceptible to that version of reality?
Well, I think I think if you look at the voting and where Trump won and did well, not surprisingly, in states that are very partisan, that are Republican, that believe in small government, the entire Midwestern swath, we used to call it the Farm Belt for the country, but also he won barely in Wisconsin, obviously Pennsylvania and Michigan, but he won, and he won with the votes of people who literally do not feel that they're doing well, and the fact that there's a number out there. It doesn't matter to them. Their kids can't stay in their hometown and get a job at the factory or the plant or any other business that used to employ them. And they're seeing their whole life change so rapidly. And they, responded to Trump, who said, listen, I'm going to restore it. I'm going to bring it back to you. So I think that's real for them. I don't think we should try to say that that's fake. I think that is a real experience a lot of people have been through. And I think that the Democrats were relying on other factors about Trump to have those people vote for Hillary Clinton. But I think that segment of the population said, you haven't done anything for us. We're going to try something new.
Here's a part of the speech that has been much remarked on. Let's listen.
The crime and the gangs and the drugs that have stolen too many lives and robbed our country of so much unrealized potential. This American carnage stops right here and stops right now.
Wendy and Michael, I have to admit, I squirm every time I hear him talk about, quote, the inner city as these places of crime infestation and gang rule and decay. I mean, we've got Minneapolis, St. Paul, where people are moving back into the core cities. Wendy, you're in Providence. What's happening there? And what do you think about this rhetoric?
Well, I think there's a problem and a real problem, and then there's the problem of stereotyping.
Uh-huh.
We don't want to stereotype inner cities. We don't stereotype people who live in inner cities, race, creed, color, religion, anything. We don't want to be doing that in American politics, period. But there are realities that people in poor neighborhoods, and that doesn't necessarily equate at all with race or ethnic origin or anything, but poverty and crime are linked, and I think there is a sense that in places like Chicago, there's parts of Chicago doing really, really well. And then there are places where hardworking people cannot feel safe in their homes. Their children are succumbing to violence on the streets. And what's the government doing about that? I'm not saying that the Trump administration will help solve that problem, but I think we have to acknowledge that that is a problem that we as a whole entire society have to reconcile. And we have to deal with it and not just pretend that everybody in every city is doing really well.
Michael, would you weigh in on that?
Yes, Washington, D.C. is among the most gentrified cities in America right now. Crime has been down and trending down for a number of years. And while Wendy is right that there's a reality on the ground in some of these places, it's also true that that reality includes reducing crime. President Trump talked about it in the context of government action, but it's also true that what goes on in cities and states is primarily responded to by state and local governments, not the national government. And so if President Trump wants to look at issues like educational crime and violence, then, you know, he ought to be paying attention to what's going on in the states and not give the impression that this is something that he can do as president of the United States, because as we know, that is just not the way things work. Now, he's done himself a bit of a disservice here in that he has created an unrealistic expectation that he can fix it on his own, and he can't. No president can.
Call here from Tim in Minneapolis. Hey, Tim, you wanted to talk about this language of the inner city? Hi.
Yes. I mean, I feel like we're living in sort of a post-David Simon's The Wire America, and yet Trump's language was very much trying to pull us back into a 1980s vision of sort of from the perspective of white people and particularly white men seeing super predators and seeing the inner city without any understanding of what it can be like to live in white America for someone who is not a white male.
I appreciate the call, Tim. You know, Wendy, as I was listening to Tim, I was thinking, we did a show a couple weeks ago on, and I don't like to use this word divide too commonly used, but the different perceptions, let's say this, if you live in cities in America and if you live in rural areas of America. And what Tim just said and what I heard from President Trump sounded like, again, that kind of clarion call to the people that live outside the cities and have this perception. And by the way, some stereotypes that go both ways about who people are depending on where they live.
Right. I mean, I think that's correct. I think what we have to think about is sort of where we think about economic opportunity and how we think about that. If we just sort of have a national plan to restore economic opportunity to rural areas, what does that do to people who live in cities and inner cities who may not have access to get out of the city and go to work? Are we going to boost mass transportation? People have to drive an hour or take a bus an hour to go get a job. We want economic development all throughout the United States. And that's the other concern with the Trump economic plan. If it's only targeted towards out of the city, then you have a lot of people who live in cities that won't have access to those jobs.
Right. Wendy Schiller, I'm sorry, Michael, you wanted to say?
Yeah, I just wanted to add quickly, you know, Wendy hits on something that's very important, because if you look at the demographic shifts in America, people are going back to cities. So if your economic policy is focused on the suburbs or the exurbs, then you're literally saying to those people who are interested in moving back to cities, I don't have much for you.
Right. And Michael, just building on that, one of the other things that has real concern for me is that we live in a new sort of creative economy, right? And we have very different kinds of jobs available. And the people who own those businesses or fund those businesses or work there may not want to go to areas that they view as very different from them or not tolerant to what they believe in. So you'll have a lot of money and a lot of new kinds of jobs funneled to the same places and further isolate rural areas or areas that have suffered economic decline because people don't want to live there because those people are different from them. So that's the way this divisive rhetoric can really isolate economic improvement and deny some areas economic improvement because people aren't going to want to move there.
Michael?
Yeah, I don't think there's any question about that. When you look at here in Washington, D.C., for example, you look at the people who are moving here, almost all of them are white millennials who grew up in suburbs. And they don't want to be isolated out in the middle of nowhere in some parts of the country. And so in the creative economy jobs, you know, those can be housed anywhere. But if you want to go where the talent is, you got to go to the cities. And so I just think that it leaves me to wonder if President Trump understands where the country is moving, where people want to be, and the kinds of economic opportunities that will be available going forward. He keeps talking about returning factory jobs.
Right.
But the reality
is those
jobs are never going to return in any meaningful ways because the nature of American economy, the American economy is moving toward information-based jobs, and those smokestack industry jobs are going overseas to cheaper labor markets abroad, and they aren't coming back.
Michael, here's the – I was just thinking this as you were saying that. The puzzling thing about the way he talks about these factory jobs – it is as if we found people to do it more cheaply somewhere else. You can have those exact same jobs back when I onshore them to America, except the kind of jobs that people will do in those factories has changed significantly. Much more higher tech, more education and training needed for that. He set up expectations here that are going to be hard to fulfill around that, hasn't he?
The only way that works quickly is if people take wages that are so low that it makes sense to onshore those jobs, and that's just not going to happen.
Wendy?
Well, no, I mean, I think that's one part. But this is where Trump could be an effective pressure point on Congress by funding things like we do in Rhode Island, which is pairing high schools and community colleges and vocational training with businesses that need higher tech employees, people who know robotics, people who know how to use the computer to run the machines that are in our factories and doing assembly. And we are putting money into that, public money and private money. If Trump could get Congress to authorize money for states and localities to do that, he could actually help retrain people who have been left behind in the very areas that he wants to. It's just a question of whether he's going to actually put that in as a priority for himself. But he could push Congress to do that, and that would create opportunities of the kinds that you're talking about, Carrie, with really high-tech retraining, which is what I think every community will probably want.
And Wendy, no doubt on that, but I've never forgotten an Atlantic magazine article that I've read about retraining. It is not as simple. And a lot of the pilot programs have not been highly successful. It's not as simple as saying, okay, you did that job, now come in for this training and you'll be ready for this high-tech world in manufacturing.
That's very true. It's like, you know, you get older, it is harder to change and harder to learn. There's no question. But if you are a family and your kids can't stay in the community because they don't have skills, but now all of a sudden the locality, the city, the state is providing an opportunity for your kids to get trained mm-hmm. and get one of those good jobs, that restores some of the stability in the areas of people who seem to be the most angry. So if you can't help the people who are 50, you can at least start to train their kids and even grandchildren to be able to sustain an economic life and a life in those communities. So I agree with you, it's not so easy, but retraining and training are a little bit different, and I think we have to invest in that kind of training across the board.
Wendy Schiller is one of our guests. If you've tuned in, she's chair of the political science department at Brown University. Michael Fauntroy with us, a familiar voice on the show. He's a politics professor at Howard University, and we're getting their thoughts and insights and yours on the vision that President Trump communicated in his inaugural speech and some of the things that he has said following that, and how that fits with your vision of America, where we are and where we're going. 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000 on Twitter at Carrie NPR, and to Brian in Minneapolis. Hey, Brian, thanks so much for waiting. Hi.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call.
Sure. What are you thinking about?
I know you love books, so I'm going to suggest that everybody read The Shock Doctrine by Naomi Klein.
Yes, right. I have read it. It's excellent.
Oh, great. Yeah. So it talks about how, you know, talking about carnage and painting that bleak picture actually serves a policy agenda. In this case, talking about, you know, really focusing on crime justifies building out the incarceration state, like whether it's prisons or detention centers. And also provides cover for state legislatures, like we see in Minnesota and Indiana and North Dakota, that are proposing laws to criminalize peaceful protests.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call there, Brian. Jessica says, I grew up in small town Iowa and now live by the U. Trump was speaking the language of everyone I knew growing up, and to Jason in St. Cloud. Hi, Jason.
Good morning.
Hi.
I just had a question regarding the unemployment numbers. I keep hearing, you know, unemployment's down. I'm wondering if that is a bit misleading. I keep seeing reports of the number of Americans not in the workforce approaching record numbers or at record numbers. I'm wondering if one of your panelists could speak on that.
Michael, are we talking underemployment here or unemployment, and how do we factor all of that in?
The caller raises an important point. The federal unemployment rate is an imperfect number, and it has been adjusted over the years to suit the needs of whichever administration is in power. And so I don't want to suggest that it's the only number we need to be focused on. And the number of people outside the workforce, that is to say those who've given up looking, is an important point to factor in as well. However, the real unemployment rate, which is a number that has been created recently to give a better sense of the total number of people who are either unemployed or underemployed and for whatever reason, is still substantially lower than it was 8 years ago. And so I don't know that there's any sort of number that can be created to suggest that the unemployment in the country is not better now than it was then. But again, to the earlier point that I made, and also one that was made by, I think, the caller, the current administration needs to have people thinking things are as bad as possible so that if things do turn around, they're able to claim credit.
Wendy, I wanted to ask you about something that Molly Ball wrote about in The Atlantic on Friday. She asked, will Republicans give Trump what he wants, even when it contradicts what they once professed to believe in? Will they have any choice? This is not just the question for members of the Republican National Committee. It's the question that will determine the course of Trump's presidency in GOP-occupied Washington. How would you answer that?
Well, I mean, I think we have no idea what Trump wants. It changes. I mean, he's only been in a couple of days, but we don't really know what he himself wants. I don't think he's thought about it. I don't think he thought he was going to win this election. So it's going to take a little while before Trump realizes the connection between what he's proposing and whether he's liked or disliked, whether he wants to have just a combative presidency and not try to win anybody else over. But the inaugural speech was important. He was giving notice to Congress that they're not going to get everything that they want, that he doesn't trust them. He's suspicious of their motives. So I don't know how smooth this will be. They will send him everything they want to get enacted and hope that he signs it. It's unclear to me when he's going to put his sort of flag in the ground and say, no, I want this. He wants infrastructure because he wants to put his name on those successes. They don't want to spend the money on it. To me, that is going to be one of the battles we see
exactly.
in the next couple months.
Exactly. Michael, I think that's going to be a fascinating negotiation, political negotiation, to see what happens. Because right now, they are talking about a fraction of the size of an infrastructure package that he wants. What do you think happens with that?
Well, to me, infrastructure is going to be the really, really big story here. Please recall that President Obama, when he came in, was talking about big on infrastructure.
Exactly.
Republicans were saying, we can't spend this kind of money. It doesn't exist. It's not going to work. We don't have the money in the budget. And here we are now with a higher federal debt, rather, and President Trump is talking about an even bigger package. And so if the Republicans roll over and give him all or almost all of what he wants, then we'll know that, at least in my opinion, that they aren't as serious about the budget deficit as they initially professed, and that they are a little concerned about his impact and his influence on the electorate as it pertains to their individual political aspirations as members of the House and Senate.
You know, Wendy, I feel like we're getting a taste of this, too, when we're seeing this back and forth on the Affordable Care Act, because when President Trump gives interviews, he's saying we're going to repeal it and replace it in the same hour, if not the same day. Well, you've got to say, if the GOP had that replace plan ready to go, where is it? They're struggling to figure out how to make all the numbers work, aren't they?
Well, I don't think that plan exists. I mean, the GOP has publicly been against Obamacare.
You don't think any plan exists?
No,
really?
They never wanted to see this kind of expansion. The biggest expansion part of Affordable Care is Medicaid expansion. So now they're going to roll Medicaid into a block grant program. That's what they want to try to do. The Senate still has a filibuster against legislation, not presidential nominations below the Supreme Court, but legislation. So we'll have to see. And a lot of the states that participate in the expansion, like Arizona, for example, or even Kentucky, they have Republican senators. And how are they going to cover all those people, hundreds of thousands of people in these states who have coverage under Medicaid expansion? So that's just one way in which the interests of the national GOP in Congress are going to come right straight clashing with the interests of Republican governors across the country. That's an element I don't think Trump has thought about. about or his camp at all.
Michael, there was an interesting piece on NPR this morning about John Kasich in Ohio. Of course, no fan of President Trump's, but he's a great example of what Wendy's talking about here on the ACA.
Oh, it's no question. And listen, Carrie, they've opposed this since President Obama was running for the presidency in 2008. They argued about it throughout all of 2009. They've taken more than 50 votes to repeal it in part or in place throughout all those years. And never once have they put forward an alternative plan that had any real viability. They should have had something in place on day one. And they didn't.
But
which
Michael,
tells me
I was
not really serious about.
Well, I was going to say, I think the reason they don't have anything in place is what I suggested earlier is it is very hard to make the numbers work.
Right.
On this.
Well, I don't think. Well, and by the way, I'm one who believes that they were never serious about repealing it and replacing it with something violent.
Really?
They just wanted to have it as a political cudgel to use against the Democrats and President Obama. I don't think that there's no way you can replace it with something that improves it. The only way it works with the numbers is to remove some people, or in which was it politically suicide to tell potentially millions of people, we're going to repeal it, and what we give you will leave you without insurance. That's just not real. I don't think that they're serious about it.
Wendy, what do you think?
Well, I mean, I think it's all part of a very entrenched ideology among a wing, but not everybody in the GOP in Congress, that wants the federal government to be smaller. And they want things to return to state control. That's what they believe. Everything, right? Infrastructure, education, health care, everything go back to the states because you can then shrink the size of the federal government. That's what they believe. So it's sort of a reflective exercise. Everything should go back to the states. The problem is the states can't afford everything, and that's been true for now 70, 80 years. So I don't know how you do that when Americans have become quite used to a lot of the things that they receive from the federal government, including rural older voters who get Social Security and Medicare. And so I think this is going to become, and you notice not a word about Medicare.
Oh, yeah.
I think everybody should pay attention to that. Paul Ryan, that has gone from the conversation. So I think that's a very interesting development in the early part of the Trump administration. Medicaid, but not Medicare.
Yeah. Michael, and the reason that we don't hear anything about Medicare is, it's just one of those issues that is, there's really never upside on reforming Medicare for a political party, is there? I mean,
no,
there might be financial upside, but political upside, that's tough.
Yeah, but however, Carrie, it's ironic in that many people who voted for Donald Trump supported someone who's talking about reforming or getting rid of many of these programs. And many of those same people need those very programs and live in states that could not possibly provide a legitimate or viable alternative. And so it's in many ways a sort of vicious cycle that's taking place right now in American politics. There are a number of American voters who don't want to acknowledge that they are actually socialists if they support and want some of these kinds of programs. And that's just a reality that some people, unfortunately, may have to get hurt before they understand that actually not all socialism is bad socialism.
I think this is a really important point, because when you look at the map of where the ACA is being used most strongly, the Affordable Care Act and these exchanges, you see a lot of counties and a lot of states that went for Donald Trump. So you wonder, Wendy, if voters realize that what they're getting right now, which they may not be in love with, it may not be perfect, but what's at risk here when they hear the people that they voted for say, we're going to take it away?
Well, this is, to me, the biggest political risk that the GOP is taking on, because they're going to have nothing in place. There'll be nothing in place because states don't have the money to replace this. So there'll just be nothing, and they'll lose their coverage. And then they won't have President Obama to blame. And if you're thinking about sort of racial rhetoric, they won't have the black president. They won't have the female President Clinton. They'll have President Trump and Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan and the entire GOP, which is clearly running the country wholesale. That's a big risk. The GOP is counting on depressed turnout in the midterms in 2018. They're counting on the Democrats not to get their act together at the local level. But I think we've seen politics turn on a dime in the last decade, in particular 2010, 2016. And I think when people people realize they will not be able to go to the doctor and get coverage, that is going to hit them likely starting as early as the fall, but into next year. Even if they delay the implementation of the repeal, insurance companies are going to get out because they don't see an upside. I think this could be an incredible mobilizer for cross coalitions among people who receive these benefits who will no longer get them.
By the way, more details on this repeal, replace the Affordable Care Act on Wednesday morning at 9 o'clock. And I'll be thinking about some of what Michael and Wendy have said about the politics of that. To the phones to Derek in Plymouth. Hey, Derek. Hi.
Hi. Good morning. Thanks
morning.
For taking my call.
Sure. Go right ahead.
It's funny, all weekend long and now even this morning. And I know you're being a moderator and you're asking the questions, but Trump's major position during the speech was the rest of America suffered while the elites enriched themselves over the last, whatever, 30 years.
Yes.
And then all weekend long, and starting today, also including today, was, hey, what's everyone complaining about? We're doing fine from the elites. So I think if you're an elite and you didn't like the speech and you're an average American, you did like it, it just shows where you stand on the spectrum, whether you benefited or not in the last 30 years. And as a cultural conservative and also as someone who's seeing my expenses go up while my pay stays flat, I'm part of the people who are saying something's going wrong here. And then when you see the change in Washington, D.C. and in Northern Virginia and all the money that's there, it's flush in the federal government. You say someone's benefiting here and it's not necessarily me.
Derek, I think what you've said is undeniable. And I you might have missed the first 20 minutes of the show where we talked about, you know, how the economic statistics, right, lower unemployment, bump up against the reality of what you've been talking about, right? People that haven't had raises for a while, increasing costs. Were you able to catch that or did you get in a little later?
No, I think I probably did miss that.
Okay. Which is fine. I love to have your view. I think, Michael and Wendy, this kind of brings us back again to the contradictions that President Trump is going to have to navigate here in his legislative agenda.
Well, the president just said, President Trump just said today, he's going to make America much more business friendly. He's going to cut corporate taxes. He's going to cut business taxes. Who do you think that benefits the most? Corporations. And it does benefit people with stock market accounts. And again, that's a hidden elite. I think your caller is exactly right. Those people are elite, too. It's just that everybody has a lot of their retirement money in the stock market. So we cheer when it goes up. But when it goes up, it's usually corporate America doing something to cut costs, which means lowering wages or laying off workers. So I don't think you can do what Trump wants to do for the business community and also help the average worker keep their job or earn more money, because those are antithetical to corporate profits, which drives the stock market.
Wendy, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for the time this morning.
Thanks, Carrie.
Wendy Schiller, Chair of the Political Science Department at Brown University. Michael, I hope we talk again soon. Glad you're doing well.
Thank you. Looking forward to it.
Michael Fauntroy, politics professor at Howard University. I think you heard some of the theme developing here in this conversation and so many when we talk about politics, who we are, how we see the world. That's the angle that I'll be talking about on Indivisible. That's a new national call-in show. We're collaborating with WNYC out of New York. You'll hear it nationwide. And I'll be out of St. Paul on Thursday nights at 7 o'clock as we talk about identity and politics. I hope you'll tune in and call in.